Kurt Anderson, a renaissance man if there ever were one, hosts Studio 360, that's the radio show from Takeaway co-producers WNYC and Public Radio International. Obviously, famously of Spy Magazine, he's just published a new novel called True Believers. Many of you may have read his earlier novel, Heyday. Most of the action of the new book takes place in the 1960s. Obviously, an incredibly important decade of transformation in the U.S. And throughout the novel, the narrator, who's a law professor named Karen Hollander, and at one point a candidate for Supreme Court, talks about the social upheaval of the 1960s and the way it influenced her life in the present time when she's actually writing. Kurt also talked about that very issue, the social and economic consequences of the 1960s, in a recent op-ed for our partner, The New York Times. He joins us here in studio today. First of all, congratulations. I haven't finished it yet because I only got it a few days ago, but what a page-turner this book is.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Celeste.
I know this is probably a lame question, but I had to wonder as I was reading it, did you have to go back and really pour through all the Bond novels and movies yet again?
Not only pour through them yet again, I'd seen most of the Bond movies. I had never read a James Bond book.
Really?
I had this idea that these kids would be obsessed with James Bond, and it, as you say, it sort of is a thread throughout the novel. But no, I had to read them, and they're much better than I imagined. They're actually good, and of course, part the her 60s that she's talking about in this memoir, this fictional memoir, begin in the early 60s, and what I tried to do is show that sort of fade, rather quick fade, from the early 60s of Bond and the Cold War and all that to what we know as the 60s, the late 60s. But no, I read about half of Ian Fleming's oeuvre.
Well, you know, it's actually a pretty brilliant way of describing that change of generation as these kids become kind of disenchanted with the whole Bond persona. You know, but the book is so generational. I mean, it takes place in a number of times, but you've got Karen Hollander herself, and you've got her great dad. What a great character he is, having escaped from the Nazis.
You may feel differently by the end of the book about her dad, but yes.
Well, but he's a great character.
Thank you.
And then you move on to her granddaughter, who becomes part of the Occupy movement as well. And that becomes your way to sort of talk about the decades in the U.S. and the characters who in your book were identified with those eras.
No, that's right. And one of the things that interested me at the beginning, once I'd sort of established the main character, this Karen Hollander person, is to sort of talk about and suss out what it was like to be 17 in 1967, which I wasn't, versus what it's like to be 17 now, which of course I'm not either. But the idea of that being on the verge of everything possible, and in both Karen and her granddaughter's case, everything's pretty screwed up.
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of different themes running through here. And I can't help but feel that you, obviously, as a reasonably news-obsessed person, are making a comment about some of the headlines of today. I mean, obviously, there's the theme of the Supreme Court. She bowed out of the nominating process of the Supreme Court. Although, I have to ask you, did she really bow out because she was afraid someone would find out about her past?
Oh, for sure. I mean, what would her other reason be? I mean, or that she, not even so much necessarily, since she's kept her secret for 45 years, but that she was just tired. She was tired of living this big lie about this episode in her past, and just, you know, she would be, she figured, spending the rest of her life waiting for the other shoe to drop. Yeah.
The big lie, though, is what kind of speaks to me through this, because she's become disenchanted with the very system that has made her successful. The fact that she has been able to sustain this lie to a certain extent repulses her.
That's exactly right. And it slightly repulses her. I mean, she is a sort of exemplar of her generation in many ways, the sense that she got away with murder. She got away with so much that she's had her cake and ate it too. She was a young radical and did drugs and did all that stuff that so many, you know, ambitious young people in 1968 did, but has had this perfectly prosperous, celebrated life as an attorney and author. She just... Her Catholic girlhood, her desire to confess and get be at one with her God in whom she doesn't believe, is powerful. That's really what is driving her, I think, now.
But it also brings us to your op-ed, in which you argue that to a certain extent the 1960s made us selfish.
Yeah.
And is that possible? What we really see in your novel is the natural self-obsession of teenagers becoming a movement, that people were paying more attention to them perhaps than they deserved.
I couldn't have said it better. Exactly. That at a certain point in 1965, 66, 67, 68, suddenly all, you know, the impatience and self-righteousness and self-obsession
and
of teenagers, it was suddenly acknowledged and validated by the culture at large in a way that it never had been. And this is only, you know, a decade or two, arguably, after sort of the teenager has been invented. And suddenly there's these millions and millions of teenagers saying what they're saying and thinking they're experiencing everything for the first time. And Time Magazine and the networks and the culture are saying, yes, kids, tell us what's right. And I you know, it was an amazing time in so many ways. And in the op-ed piece, I don't argue that selfishness began in the late 60s, but that a certain kind of it's all about me and I want to do what – if it feels good, do it – was unleashed in this sort of extreme way that's always been, you know, present in the American character.
But this is obviously something that you put a lot of thought to. This is your generation.
I'm a little younger, but yes, I'm at the younger end of the baby boom generation.
You watched
for sure.
This. You watched the 1960s as they unfolded as a kid.
Yeah.
And you must have thought to a great deal about, as you watched the succeeding generations, what effect that obsession with teenage wisdom, if there is such a phrase, what effect that has had on the children and the grandchildren.
Well, I think we have, starting with my generation, become a kind of permanently adolescent culture in a lot of ways. All the ways in which people, as they go from 18 to 25, let's say, are no longer required to grow up in so many ways. Some ways that are great. The fact that I'm wearing sneakers right now, the fact that I wear jeans every day. That's good by me, but certainly that was not true. That sense of I could always kind of be youthy, even as a 55-year-old, was not the case. And so in lots of ways, good and bad, we Americans and to some degree the Western world was given a permission to never quite grow up, to stay forever young into from adolescence into dotage.
Forever Young, which, you know, you also mention Dylan's version of that song in your book, which is kind of an echo there. But are you kind of equating some of the social movements of today with the adolescent social movements of the 1960s?
Well, I don't know about equating. Mark Twain famously was supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So I think there is a rhyme here. And it's interesting. I made this granddaughter of the main character,
Waverly,
this protester wants to go to G20 summits and protest and make noise. I finished this book just before there was an Occupy movement. So suddenly I finished this book last summer, and a month later I'm seeing my imaginary protesters come to life. So that was, and I had to actually go back and fleck in the name Occupy.
You had to fleck in the name Occupy because you found yourself being oddly prescient. That must have made you feel pretty
not
smart.
Quite prescient enough. It would be nice if it had come out a year before Occupy. But yeah, no, the world caught up with me. And again, I became interested in drones. And there's, as you know, there are lots of drone discussion in this book. And that's, you know, a big deal. People are talking today, more today at this second, more about the Supreme Court than they were when I was finishing. So, no, I lucked out in many
In many echoes of what you're doing. But your basic idea is that although we tend to idolize the 1960s, maybe we're fantasizing.
Well, there were great things about the 1960s and social equality and civil rights and so many other things. But it's there, you know, lots of things had roots in the 1960s. You know, the left likes some of them, doesn't like some of them. The right likes some of them, doesn't like some of them. But it's a, you know, you have to look at the full sweep of the impact, it seems to me.
Kurt Anderson is host of Studio 360 on our co-producer WNYC. The book is called True Believers. It's a great book. I haven't finished it yet, so don't tell me anything, Kurt.
No spoilers.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Celeste.